Hello. Welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader from Flagstaff, Deborah McFadder, with excerpts from Yes Media, a nonprofit independent publisher of solutions journalism. Through rigorous reporting on the positive ways communities are responding to social problems and insightful commentary that sparks constructive discourse, Yes Media inspires people to build a more just, sustainable, and compassionate world. Previously, we had been reading an article, A Crop for a Saltier Future, from the Sustainable Food and Farming column, written by Ashley Stimson, first published January 10th, 2025. As you recall, we had been reading about a plant called Salicornia and how it thrives in salty, brackish water and is being used around the world to replace other crops. We'd finished with a little bit about what was happening in Vietnam and how this crop was being sold to high-end restaurants in the city where chefs incorporated into dishes like Salicornia marinated gazpacho and Salicornia pakora. In eastern Ghana, the organization is working with villagers in the low-lying Volta Delta to restore mangrove forests that have been cut down or overfished and sow Salicornia in the adjacent lagoons. For now, the plant will be used as fish food in aquaculture projects, said Nyberg. These projects are largely in trial stages, with profit and scalability still a question mark, but a challenge, according to Nyberg, is sourcing reliable seeds. Right now, we're selecting plants from the wild, ones that perform well, and we dish those out, Nyberg said. Usually only about 50% survive. It's definitely quantity over quality. These are pretty wild plants, so germination is erratic, said Arjen de Vos, whose Netherlands-based organization, the Salt Doctors, develops climate-resilient agricultural systems in salt-affected parts of the world. Getting their hands on good seeds is difficult for farmers. There are other obstacles standing in the way of the broad adoption of Salicornia as a food crop, de Vos says. For one thing, little research has been done on pests or diseases that might affect these plants. Another larger issue is developing a market for the crop. If there's no market for it, no farmer will grow it. Efforts are underway to introduce consumers to Salicornia. In the United Arab Emirates, the nonprofit's World Wildlife Foundation and International Center for Biosaline Agriculture brought together the country's top chefs to familiarize them with the food and ways to use it in their menus. Salicornia startups have popped up in Portugal and Poland and in Ireland. A popular Dublin restaurant features the salty vegetable in the menu. For now, de Vos said most farmers are taking stopgap steps to adapt to increasing salinity, such as installing drainage systems and breeding conventional vegetables to be more salt tolerant. But he worries even those strategies may not be sustainable in the long term. Rainy seasons are becoming shorter. People are tapping deeper and deeper where the groundwater is saltier. The world is running out of fresh water, he said. We may not be there yet, but Salicornia will be very needed. Molino, who's not involved in DeVos or Nyberg's projects, said there's something of a consortium of people around the world working to make Salicornia a viable crop for a warmer, saltier future. It's a little bit of a competitive space, she said, with some scientists like her working on domestication and others working on promoting a culinary relationship with the plant. The two can and should happen alongside each other. The scientist is hopeful that as research continues, Salicornia's trajectory will look something like quinoa, another salt-tolerant crop. The Andean grain, prized by indigenous cultures, was neglected for centuries before being rediscovered in the last half of the 20th century and heavily promoted by the United Nations. In 1980, 8 countries grew quinoa. Today, that number is close to 100. By 2034, the grain you couldn't find on grocery store shelves a decade ago is projected to hit $2.78 billion in global sales. With enough investment and interest, Molino believes salicornia might one day be as popular, and that saltwater, instead of being a foe to the world's food supply, might be its friend. This story is part of an ongoing series of reporting on a just and climate-friendly food system produced in collaboration with The Guardian, Nexus Media News, Sentient, and Yes Magazine, with funding from the Solutions Journalism Network, advisory support from Garrett Broad, Rowan University, and audience engagement through Project Drawdown's Global Solutions Diary. About the author. Ashley Stimson is a Maryland-based freelance journalist whose work runs the gamut from science and travel writing to profiles and investigative features. Mostly, she writes about wildlife and conservation. Sometimes she writes about people, particularly members of invisible or disappearing subcultures. Every once in a while, she writes essays. When she's feeling real squirrely, she writes poetry. She's written for The Guardian, National Geographic, Popular Mechanics, Reader's Digest, Long Reads, Wired, Atlas Obscura, Johns Hopkins Magazine, Chesapeake Bay Magazine, Washingtonian, Field and Stream, Blue Ridge Outdoors, and more. Her literary nonfiction has appeared in Entropy, The Common, Kamas, Kajibi, Brevity's Nonfiction Blog, Potomac Review, Little Patuxent Review, and elsewhere. She also served as a ghostwriter or co-writer on memoirs that have been or will be published by Grand Central Publishing, G.P. Putnam and Sons, and Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Her work has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize, anthologized in the year's best sports writing, and recognized with Edgar Award for Fact Crime from the Mystery Writers of America. Moving on to an article from the news section, Recovery in San Diego a Year After the Floods. This was written by Claudia Boyd Barrett, first published February 13, 2025. The color photograph at the beginning shows a man, Emmanuel Hurtado, owner of H&H Renovations, working as he installs new windows in units in Southcrest destroyed by the January 22 floods. The photograph shows a man in a blue t-shirt with overalls. He has dark hair. He's looking down at something that we can't see right now, but he's obviously in the inside of a building where we can see the exposed insulation in the walls. Behind him is a clothesline with towels or blankets over it, and the sun is hitting the trees that are way back behind him. Jessica Calix has tried to make the 33-foot travel trailer she and her son Chaco share at a North San Diego RV park feel like their old rental home in the Southcrest neighborhood. She set up benches and toys outside for Chaco and his friends to play with, strung lights over the trailer the way she used to over her front door, and hung up a smiling sun ornament that looks like the one they lost in the flooding that devastated parts of southeastern San Diego on January 22, 2024. But lately, Chaco has been asking Calix a question that breaks her heart, one that she doesn't know the answer to. Will we ever live in an apartment again? I basically tell him, we're not going to be able to move soon, Calix said, sitting outside her trailer on a recent evening. How do I explain the current housing market to an 8-year-old? Calix and Chaco are among approximately 5,000 San Diego area residents impacted by the historic downpour last January that led to dramatic flooding in parts of the city and county, with particularly severe damage in Southcrest and Shelltown. The mother and son were among hundreds of people who suffered severe property damage and displacement. 5 people died. While some flood survivors have been able to return home, many others are still struggling to recover, rebuild their homes, or find new places to live. Some survivors, particularly renters like Calix, have been forced to restart life elsewhere with little hope of returning to their old communities. Extreme flooding events, even in regions typically associated with dry weather like Southern California, are becoming more common as the climate warms. Climate change, driven primarily by burning fossil fuels, is changing weather patterns. leading to heavier and more dangerous downpours that can overwhelm the infrastructure designed for more predictable times. Here there's a photograph taken through a doorway of one building looking out towards another. The building that we're looking at has pale blue exterior walls. A man is going inside with a toolbox. He's some sort of a construction worker. The screen door is black wrought iron, and the inside door is white. There's a white awning over the door. And the caption says that he is repairing this building that was damaged so badly in the 2024 floods. The owner did not have flood insurance, but a local foundation is helping pay for repairs. But Calix and others impacted by the disaster insist there is another force that exacerbated the flooding, one that also led to what many see as a disjointed and inadequate disaster response, decades of government neglect and indifference toward San Diego's lower-income neighborhoods. These neighborhoods, located primarily in southeastern San Diego, where much of the flooding happened, are among the most economically stressed and environmentally burdened areas in the region. They were also historically redlined, a racist government-sponsored practice that made it difficult for people in those neighborhoods to get financial services, such as mortgages and insurance, and concentrated low-income and people of color in flood-prone areas. Residents say the legacy of discrimination continues to this day through lack of city investment in flood control infrastructure and inadequate disaster planning and support for those affected. The result is even greater hardship and precarity for people and communities already on the edge. The situation is also a microcosm of the inequitable distribution of risks from climate change, and an example of the challenges communities and governments must grapple with as floods and other weather-related disasters become more frequent. What happened on that day was a planning disaster, says Andrea Guerrero, executive director of Alliance San Diego, a community organization whose offices in Barrito Logan were damaged in the flood. That climate event happened throughout the county, but where was it felt? It was felt in the places where the city had failed to modernize and update its infrastructure. Alliance San Diego is among approximately 700 people and organizations now suing the city, alleging it failed to maintain stormwater infrastructure and instead prioritized investments in wealthier communities. They point to a 2020 city report that said segments of Cholas Creek, which flooded during the storm, had not been maintained and had the potential to cause property damage. The lawsuit also notes the city's admission of a severe lack of funding to maintain stormwater infrastructure. Last year, the city estimated it needed about $9 billion in infrastructure upgrades. You are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. Remember, you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Continuing with our story, Nicole Darling, Director of Communications for the City of San Diego, said it does not comment on pending litigation, but she said the city dispatched more than 300 staff members to clean out storm drains and inlets before the rainstorm, including critical drains in the Cholas Creek area. One segment, close to Beta Street in Southcrest, which suffered severe damage, was scheduled for upcoming debris removal at the time the storm happened, she said in an email. Darling emphasized that the storm was historic and its impact unpredictable. This was an unprecedented storm, she said. It was the fourth wettest day in history. We've never seen this level of flooding before. Guerrero and others participating in the lawsuit said they want the city to compensate survivors for their losses and do more to prevent the Cholas Creek stormwater channel from flooding. Some community organizers and flood survivors are demanding other changes as well. Clarissa Marin, chief financial officer for the Harvey Family Foundation, a community organization that has been on the front lines of helping those affected, said the response on the ground has been chaotic. She said local authorities need to work in collaboration with residents to create a disaster preparedness plan that reflects what community members need so that they can be better prepared for future disasters. She and other residents interviewed said they also want the city and county to provide more support to help the many survivors, both homeowners and former renters, who either didn't receive aid or didn't get enough to help them rebuild their lives. This would include assisting people like Calix, who was displaced from the floods but didn't benefit from county and city financial aid, to help them find housing. All of our resiliency planning should be community-driven, Marin says. It shouldn't be about scrambling to tell residents what I can do for you, what you are going to have to accept. Darling pointed out to various efforts by the city to support flood survivors, including money for temporary lodging and help for small businesses. She said city officials have been attending public meetings and listening to community feedback since the disaster. She added that the city has also been distributing pamphlets to residents living in floodplain areas about how to prepare for potential flooding in the future. Now we see a photograph of Cholos Creek, normally dry, but here overflowed its banks and flooded the surrounding neighborhood. There is a bridge over this area with stairs going up to it, but you can see that the water backed up and brush and other things have accumulated down in this area in the creek bed. Neglected communities. Calix, who is part African American, like the multicultural community in the area around Beta Street in Southcrest, where she and Chago settled in 2020. The sounds and smells were familiar. She felt comfortable. She liked the cost of rent even more. $1,500 for two bedrooms, the same as she'd paid for a one-bedroom apartment in the northern, more expensive part of the city. About 80 years ago, the federal government categorized large swaths of southeastern San Diego, such as Southcrest, as hazardous, declaring that the properties there were high risk for defaulting on loans, largely because of the people who lived there, laborers, immigrants, and people of color. Although redlining has since been outlawed, its impact continues to this day, with people in historically redlined communities experiencing higher rates of poverty and ill health than those in other non-redlined areas. Southcrest, Shelltown, and other neighborhoods that suffered flood damage, including Logan Heights and Barrio Logan, have disproportionately higher rates of residents living in poverty compared to other parts of the city. These residents are also exposed to other negative factors that can impact their health, such as pollution from diesel fumes, hazardous waste sites, and lead from housing, according to California's Environmental Protection Agency. It's these types of economically and environmentally stressed locations that climate scientists say are most vulnerable to flooding, and where populations have the hardest time recovering from natural disasters. People of color, and those living in mobile homes in particular, are disproportionately exposed to flooding, research shows, and these same populations, as well as low-income people in general, have the most difficulty accessing federal flood disaster assistance. We know that risks of climate change are absolutely higher in communities of concern or communities that are historically marginalized, says Darby Berry, Director of Climate and Environmental Programs at the University of San Diego's Nonprofit Institute and Director of the San Diego Regional Climate Collaborative. But southeastern San Diego is also a haven for people priced out from more affluent areas of the city. Some neighborhoods are full of paid-off homes where families have lived for generations. Low-wage workers and immigrants are also drawn here, looking for an affordable place to rent in a city where the cost of housing seems to rise by the day. Here's a color photograph of a couple walking down the sidewalk that is in front of a little beige-colored square-shaped house. Amon Harvey, president and founder of the Harvey Family Foundation, and Clarissa Marin, the foundation's CFO, visit homes on Beta Street that their organization has been helping repair. There are still many more families with damaged homes that need help. This little house has a small tree in front of it that looks like it's a yucca plant that has been trimmed quite a bit. and the grass around it is dried out looking. There are new windows put in the front of the house, you can tell. A shocking loss. Calix's son, Jago, turned 8 the day the flood destroyed their rental home. The day started out normal enough. Calix dropped her son off at school in Point Loma, resisting Chago's pleas to let him stay home for his birthday. It was drizzling, but she thought nothing of it. She promised to deliver some treats for him and his classmates later in the day and drove to a nearby party supply store. But during her drive, normality ended. It started raining intensely. At an intersection, Calix noticed a car stuck in what looked like flood water. By the time she got to the party supply store, she'd passed numerous other flooded streets and stranded cars. The store was closed and the parking lot flooded. Her mind leapt to the rental apartment she and Jago shared in South Crest, 10 miles south. Was it okay? She wondered. Were my neighbors okay? It wasn't until 5 hours later, after the floodwaters receded, that Calix was able to return to South Crest and find out. She encountered devastation. Streets and homes caked in black sludge, cars piled on top of each other, dead animals, shell-shocked neighbors, some of whom had narrowly escaped drowning. Her apartment looked like the inside of a muddy blender. Her and Chago's furniture, clothes, and other possessions were destroyed, including her father's ashes and recently opened Christmas presents. To see all that devastation at once, it was very desperate, says Calix, who spent the next several days trying to salvage what she could, a couple of bikes, a pet snake. There was probably more stuff I could have saved off the walls, things up in cabinets, but I had to just walk away. I couldn't do it anymore, and neither could my kid. And here now we have a picture of Calix standing outside of a building. It looks like she's near a picnic table. She has long, dark brown hair, and she's wearing a black T-shirt, a silver necklace around her neck. Her hands are together almost in a prayer position, and she has a smile on her face, but she also has sadness around her eyes. Renters in peril. Some of the people who suffer the most in the wake of flooding and other natural disasters are renters, a population that accounts for 1/3 of U.S. households. Renters tend to have less wealth than homeowners, are less likely to have insurance to recoup lost belongings or the costs associated with displacement, and also receive less help from the government after disasters. To add insult to injury, research shows that rents for the lowest income households rise significantly after floods. In other words, the people with the fewest financial resources to weather losses from a natural disaster get the least help to recover, and then end up paying even more for housing if they're lucky enough to find another place to live. In California, and in San Diego especially, where more than 1 in 3 households already don't make enough to meet their basic needs, and where the average rent is more than $3,000 a month, losses and displacement from a flood can result in a compounding cycle of long-term financial pain and housing insecurity. That's the predicament Calix found herself in after the flooding. Even though she received $5,000 in emergency assistance from FEMA, that wasn't enough to secure another apartment rental that she could afford on her salary as a massage therapist, she said. She was also in debt from having to replace clothes, toys, and everyday items she lost in the flood, as well as extra gas and food while living in the hotels. It's overwhelming, Calix says. It shouldn't be that way. The county and city of San Diego, with support from other local cities and community organizations, as well as the federal government, have tried to mitigate the challenges facing displaced flood survivors. The county allocated $33.7 million to recovery efforts, including to help provide food, emergency lodging, fund home and infrastructure repairs, and help residents secure federal disaster aid. Some of this funding went to a program that provided temporary accommodation for people in hotels after the flooding and housed more than 2,200 people, or nearly 900 households at its peak. That program ended in June. With about $7 million in support from the county and city, the San Diego Housing Commission then provided up to $15,000 $1,000 in assistance to people still in emergency lodging near the end of the program to help them pay for rent, security deposits, and other expenses to relocate. But there have been problems. Numerous participants in the temporary lodging program have complained they were housed in unsafe or unsanitary hotels and evicted or threatened with eviction because of payment delays from the contractor hired to run the program. Many people who needed accommodation didn't even get the help because they didn't know about the program, had trouble accessing it, or were afraid to seek help because of their immigration status, says Clarissa Marin, CFO of the Harvey Family Foundation. Others left before they were ready because of conflicting information from FEMA workers that led them to believe staying in the hotels would jeopardize their federal aid money, Marin and Kallax said. The Housing Commission also limited who could apply for the financial assistance to those still in the program on May 23, a date by which many had left. That meant just 313 families initially received aid. The commission recently expanded eligibility to another 194 families who had applied but left the hotels earlier, offering them up to $5,500. But that doesn't cover all the approximately 900 families that were in the program at its peak. Kallax is one of the flood survivors and former renters who, so far, has not qualified for financial help from the Housing Commission. She decided to leave the program after 3 months because at the last hotel she stayed at, she felt unsafe. She was also hearing about other people getting evicted and got nervous that she and Chago would be next. She never applied for aid because she assumed she wouldn't qualify. Now she's angry that she and many of her neighbors have been left out. We're all in a hole, and we're trying to get out, and they just keep, you know, letting us fall deeper, she says. To be told you get no help, and other people do, it is very frustrating. Since we're at the end of our time, we'll stop there and finish this article next week as we get into what's happened to the homeowners in this area. You have been tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. From Flagstaff, I'm your volunteer reader, Deborah McFadder. Thanks a lot for listening.